A couple questions came up during break. One of them was about the Pharisees and what kind of hypocrites they were. But when I say, and just to answer that question, part of it I think would be of interest to everybody. When I say there were two kinds of hypocrites, I'm not saying they're two totally different kinds. I'm saying that probably they all started off with self-deception and self-righteousness. That would be a common thread. But some had been at it so long they didn't know. And others did know. Some probably became angry when they heard what Jesus said. Others probably felt deeply convicted. Some probably felt deeply convicted and then hid it and did not repent as they should have. One other thing maybe can be said, just to follow up from last time, and that would be that it is important to actually warn people about sin. Here's my parable. I write parables myself once in a while. Once upon a time, my parables sound different from Jesus. Jesus says, the kingdom is like, I say once upon a time. Once upon a time, a woman woke up with a severe headache on the right side of her head. It persisted somewhat severely for a number of days until finally she went to her doctor. Her doctor put her through a variety of tests, got the results, sent them to a diagnostician. They consulted, they confirmed. The woman indeed had a brain tumor. When she came to the doctor and asked for the results, the doctor, who was a tender man and a kind man and never, ever wanted to upset anybody or hurt their feelings, said, the pain you are feeling will be gone within 6 months at the most. Well, it's a true statement. Because she would die. Now, you may say that's kindness, and that's tenderness, and that's an unwillingness to offend anyone or make them feel sad. But, of course, there is a tenderness that's no kindness at all. And the tenderness that's no kindness at all is one that says everything is fine when everything isn't fine. And when somebody says, you know, God loves you, when... You know, and maybe that's not all there is to it. Maybe God also is intent upon judging you for rejecting Him. So it is no kindness. It is no sweetness. Jesus is we might say, Jesus is too kind. He's too tender. He's too merciful. He's too loving not to tell the truth. Amen. And if I can speak to some of you here who are heading for careers in counseling, It is a foolish kindness that doesn't persist to get to the root of the matter and address the root of the matter when you talk to someone instead of simply addressing that which is on the surface. So, with that, we turn to Jesus' last words to his disciples in a sustained, I'll say it this way, his last sustained discourse with his disciples. For surely he still speaks to them and will speak to them after his resurrection as well. But his last sustained discourse with them in this life. It is described in both Matthew chapter 24 and 25 and in John 13 to 17. Following our pattern of sticking primarily with Matthew, we'll do that yet tonight and maybe just say a few things about John 13 to 17 tonight. Or maybe on another evening, so we can cover that. In Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus is giving his fifth great discourse. You recall that there are several times when Jesus has what we've called a block of teaching material. And each time we have a setting with people asking him questions or making comments. And we also have each one of them ending with a very similar remark, and Matthew 25 ends with that similar remark after Jesus had said these things or something. This is the one time it doesn't end with that. But each time he says, on the other occasions, he says, after he'd finished, he went on and did something else. Here it simply says, in 26:1, actually, sorry, here it is. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, so then we know the discourse is over. It covers 24 and 25. It is about the last things. There are several questions we need to ask or things we need to consider about Jesus' teaching on last things and on the future. Now, first of all, the theme is clear enough that Jesus is teaching for his disciples on the fall of Jerusalem and on the last things. It's not just the eternal future he has in mind here, it is also the proximate future, the next 40 years in the life of his disciples. Now, we'll unfold that as time goes by. There's also a question that's prompted by this part of Jesus' teaching, and that is this truly prophetic? Because you see, the critics commonly say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written after 70 AD. Therefore, these prophecies are after the event. And not that we like to spend a lot of time interacting with critics, but this gives us a good chance to reply to those who say the Gospels were written late, they were unreliable, and the authors put things in Jesus' mouth that didn't really belong there. So a few words on the authenticity of this prophecy. Saying it's not a prophecy after the event, and the reason is that the details in this passage, Matthew 24, do not come from contemporary accounts of the fall of Jerusalem. The detailed statements come, rather, from Old Testament prophecies. Let me just walk through that with you a little bit. If you read the accounts, especially of Josephus, whom we've talked about in this class before, if you read the accounts of Josephus in his account of the history of the Jews, you find these things emphasized. Murderous infighting among the Jews, slaughtering one another in greater numbers perhaps even than the Romans slaughtered them. The Jews took refuge in the temple. I showed you pictures of the temple earlier. It was built on a mountain. Did you notice the walls of the temple? Those walls were dozens of feet high and many feet thick. And the Jewish leaders of the insurrection against Rome took over the temple and made it into a citadel. So the blood was running through the temple itself, not the blood of animals now, sacrificial animals, but the blood of humans. The temple gates were finally overcome through burning, burned with fire. And then later after that, the whole city was burned, and many of the people of Jerusalem were murdered by sword-wielding and knife-wielding Romans. None of those particular details that are so emphasized by those who were there are stressed. I'm not saying they're not there in Matthew 24, but those particular details are not what Jesus stresses. He doesn't mention, you know, there's no mention of Jewish infighting. And all that proves, then, you see, that the prophecy of Jesus is not being tailored after the event to fit contemporary recollections of the event. It wasn't written in 80 saying, okay, let's see what happened now. Okay, this is what happened, that's what happened. Let's put that in Jesus' mouth. Rather, it was written beforehand using the language that Jesus had available from the Old Testament, from Old Testament statements about God's wrath on wicked cities. That's what Jesus chose to use. So, for example, the idea that camps will be built, that the city will be encircled, that siege ramps will be erected, which in fact did happen. It did happen in the Roman conquest. But it's not the main thing that the contemporary accounts describe. Those things are taken from, and I have them in your notes, Isaiah chapter 29 and Ezekiel chapter 4 and Ezekiel 28. And the crushing of the city, the destroying of its walls, which is not emphasized by Josephus, it did happen, but it's not emphasized, is actually taken from Amos chapter 9 and Isaiah chapter 5 and Isaiah 64. The idea that the city would become a heap of stones, not one stone would rest upon another, Jesus says at one point, is actually taken from Isaiah 25, Jeremiah 26, and various other references that I have there for you. The leveling of the city and its children slain, described in Isaiah 26. And perhaps there's an allusion in one of the Psalms. So what I'm saying then is that the language is based on lamentations and words of judgment taken from Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Micah, and so on. Just to illustrate one other point. It does not ever say in Matthew, Mark, or Luke that it's the Romans who will come, does it? If the prophecy had been given after the event, it probably would have said the Romans. But instead it simply says their enemies. What Jesus said is true, it's fulfilled, but it's not tailored too cutely, we might say, to what actually happened. The flight of the Christians. Jesus says in chapter 24, verses 15 to 16, that when they see the abomination of desolation, they should flee to the mountains of Judea. You know where they actually fled to? They didn't do what Jesus said. They fled, but they fled to a city called Pella. Their lives were saved, many of them, those who remember what Jesus said. But if you were jiggering it to make it look pretty, then you would have said, the accounts would you know, they would have said, and when you see the abomination of desolation, you must go to Pella. So the Christians would all look good, right? So there are many other examples we could give of that that show that Jesus' prophecy is true, and Jesus' words were fulfilled, but there is no manipulation after the fact. Jesus did speak it when he said he did, 30-some, almost 40 years before the events, and I believe Matthew, Mark, and Luke were all written before the year 70 A.D., truly prophesying, as the accounts themselves say, let the reader understand when you see this flee. What they're saying is, listen, this is coming soon. When this happens, this is my advice for you. It's coming. Get out of there. This is prophecy given to warn the church, but also to preserve the church from receiving the judgment that was due to fall upon Israel and not due to fall upon the church. Is that clear? Can I ask if anybody wants to ask a question of clarification about that? Yes? Where's the church at? The church is slowly spreading. It's in, but it's certainly also in Jerusalem. In the year 70 AD, there would have been a lot of Christians living in Jerusalem. And this is warning them, get out, flee, because you're not ready for this. This judgment is not for you.
So the statement that Christ made to the church.
Yes.
So now it has actually started taking place of him baptizing Jew and Gentile in one body.
Let's see, that's a complicated question. Let me not answer it the way you asked it. Okay. The question is, that's a complicated question. I don't know how to put this question. What does this have to do with the prophecy, I will build my church? I would say it has to do with the idea the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That it's not going to be wiped out, and it's going to advance. And this is to make sure that that advance and that protection indeed takes place. There is a lot of controversy around the dating of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's something I haven't chosen to emphasize until now in the course. But generally speaking, critics, liberals, call them what you will, tend to say that the Gospels were written quite a long time after the events. Commonly they would put maybe John around 95 A.D. Maybe they'd put Mark at 68 or 70 or 72. Matthew and Luke, maybe 80 or 85 A.D. would be very common dates. And then of course, that implies that Matthew didn't really write it. It implies that it was written by people who didn't really know, didn't really see what was happening. That it was written by the time memories would fade and there'd be a lot of creativity in a negative sense. But I think this is one reason why I'm going into this right now, to say, no, there's evidence that it was all written within a generation. So that the authors might have been older men. Matthew might have been an older man when he wrote it. He might not have been, but he certainly wasn't dead. Dead men don't write books. And John also. There is a tradition within the church. By tradition here I mean early church figures, early church leaders. By that I mean around the year 150 A.D. and 200 A.D., said that Matthew wrote first, and if you just carefully watch what they say and look at the way there's an apparent allusion to Luke writing the gospel in 2 Corinthians, and 2 Corinthians was written in the late 50s A.D., and if Matthew was written before Luke, then Matthew would have been written in the 50s, maybe even the 40s, some people say, but there is an allusion to Luke. I don't have it. I think I want to say 2 Corinthians 7:17, but I'm not confident of that. It's just a number that pops up right now. But there's an allusion. You could just do a search on your concordance and find Luke, the brother whose praise is in the gospel, which I think means praise to Luke for writing his gospel. And that would put the dates in the 50s. John Wenham wrote a book about that called Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's a very good book. John Wenham, W-E-N-H-A-M, that you might be interested in reading. Good questions. Now I want to talk about not your questions, but about the disciples' questions. The disciples ask two questions of Jesus as they leave the temple districts. They leave the city. They look back at the city. We could perhaps imagine that it is sunset and that the gilded marble, polished stone, some said gilt with gold, were glistening in the sunset. And these men who had not often been to Jerusalem, perhaps, and had not become accustomed to beauty of this sort, said simply, "Look at the buildings." Jesus, look. Matthew says, puts the words, sorry, Matthew generalizes, Mark puts the words more in more detail in their mouth. "Look what beautiful buildings. Aren't they pretty? Wow." Jesus says, you see them? Verse 2 of chapter 24. "I tell you the truth, not one stone will be left on another. Every stone will be thrown down." The disciples asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Now here's a crucial interpretive question. How many questions are here? Okay, in your English translation, it reads as three questions. When will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? In the Greek, as you could possibly see from the English, there are two questions. The disciples run together, when will this happen? And the question, when is the sign of your coming, the end of the age? They view that as one thing. How many questions did the disciples think they were asking? They thought they were asking one. That's correct. They thought that the destruction of Jerusalem and Jesus coming and the end of the age were all one thing. They're in fact asking, a couple of you said three, and it is, you're just reading the text, and I'm not calling that a mistake. I'm just saying if you looked at it in the original language, you'd see it's really two questions. Two questions. So how many answers do you think Jesus gives? Probably gives two answers. Now, the trick, the crucial thing we have to do to understand Matthew 24 and Jesus' prophecies of the future is to comprehend when the answers start and when the answers stop. It's vital if we want to understand his teaching on the end of time. And you know that there's a lot of mistakes about this. I have I keep in a file drawer a booklet. 88 reasons. Have you seen this? 88 reasons why the rapture will take place in 1988. In my kid's school, how many of you read that book? Saw it at least. Okay, a handful of you saw it. It sold tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of copies. More like a booklet. And after that didn't happen, you know what he did in 1989? Do you know? 89 reasons why the rapture will take place in 1989. It didn't sell as well, I have to tell you. This wasn't well received. And then when he came out with 90 and 90, it just didn't work a bit. In my kid's school, just about 2 weeks ago, the word was out that at 6 p.m. on Tuesday night or something, the world was going to end. Did any of you hear about that? You know, people are always predicting. Always predicting the world's going to end. And, eventually somebody's going to hit it right because everybody's pretty, every day and every year is predicted, but no one knows. Okay, crucial question is, how do we divide what Jesus says, his answers? I'm going to say to you, this is very important, I'm going to say to you that question 1 is answered from verses 4, Matthew 24, 4, through 35. And that the second answer begins in verse 36. Now, one reason why I say it goes, the first question is answered until 35. When will these things be? When will Jerusalem fall? When will the city be destroyed? The answer goes from 4 to 35 because it ends, verse 34, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Jesus is saying the fall of Jerusalem will take place in this generation. The generation lasts 40 years, and it was probably, best guess, 37, 38 years later that Jerusalem fell. Okay? Maybe 36, maybe 34, depends on how you date some things. But late 30s of years, Jerusalem fell. Jesus said it would on this generation. It happened. Heaven and earth will pass away. My words will never pass away. I'm talking about the fall of Jerusalem. Verse 36, Jesus starts talking about his coming in the end of the age. And here's how you know it. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, not the Son of Man, but only the Father. It's going to be the way it was in the days of Noah. What was it like in the days of Noah? Noah kept saying, one of these days, it's going to rain. One of these days, it's going to rain. It is going to rain one of these days. And the people ignored him for 120 years, and then it rained. But during Noah's day, the people were simply going along marrying and giving in marriage and taking care of their needs and building their houses because they didn't believe Noah. And so they were astonished when it actually happened. And that's the way it's going to be. People will not know. They will not know when the last day is coming. They will be astonished. Now that's one thing. The days of Noah is one reason why I say we're talking about the last day. The other reason is when Jesus says no one knows about that day, the term that day is a technical phrase in biblical language. It is a technical phrase meaning the day of judgment. It was used a number of times in the Bible for the day of judgment. Some references, if you want to look it up, are Matthew 7:22. Luke 10:22, 2 Timothy 4:8, and there are a few others in the Bible. Technical term for the day of judgment. Just in case you're not clear, by technical term I mean words that have a loaded meaning. For example, there are two words that we use that have a loaded meaning. Everybody understands them. Those words are Super Bowl. If somebody says to me, I'm going to watch the Super Bowl, I am not going to read that as them saying, I'm going to go into the kitchen and watch this and look and stare at this really ornate, beautiful bowl. And no one's going to think that you know, there's an enormous cereal bowl. You know, I'm just going to fill it with 4 boxes of Wheaties, and I'm going to look at that thing, and I'm just going to exult in watching a box full of Wheaties. No one would construe my remark that way. I see people who are not from America laughing at this. Because they know, even people who hate football and come from other countries know what the Super Bowl is. It's a technical term referring to a really boring football game that takes place in the month of January. It is boring. With a long, lame halftime show. And that's what it's about. All right. Super Bowl. The commercials are the best part, somebody said. That's absolutely true. Super Bowl is a technical term. Everybody knows what it means. That day is a technical term. Everybody knew that Jesus was talking about the day of judgment. Now, if you buy into what I'm saying, and I hope you do, then you're going to have to follow me through some rough terrain. Namely, you're going to have to see a few verses in new ways. Because there are some parts of 24, 4 to 36, that you have probably read as prophecies of the end of time. Now, I want to make this very clear to you. The fall of Jerusalem was a lot like the last judgment. And so if you've read some of those prophecies as referring to the end of time, I'm not saying you're wrong, but they initially refer to the fall of Jerusalem. And then the fall of Jerusalem foreshadows the last day of judgment. Even as the fall of Babylon. Again, if you read your Old Testament, fall of Babylon, the fall of Nineveh, also for those nations was a foreshadowing of the day of judgment. For them, it was as good as the day of judgment. For the nation of Israel, the fall of Jerusalem was almost as good as their last day. Not that every last one of them was judged, but it was their day of judgment. So it's foreshadowing, it's a type, it is, if you've ever been in drama, it's a dress rehearsal for the last day. Nonetheless, it is not the play itself. That's to come. And so the prophecies, I say, must be read, first of all, as taking place in Jesus' generation. Now, what are some of them? Verse 5, there will be false Christs claiming, I am the Christ. It is absolutely true that in Jesus' day, there were not one or two, but dozens of people who stood up and said, I am the Christ, I am the Deliverer, I am the Redeemer, I am the mouthpiece of God. Simon Magus, Thutis, a man who called himself a prophet and promised to divide the Jordan. There was an Egyptian who came with 1,000 men and promised that the walls of Jerusalem would fall at his command. All those things happened in the 30-some years after Jesus' death and resurrection, just as he said. Wars and rumors of wars. There was constant rumor of war in Israel during that period of time. Constant talk of rebellion against Rome. And not only there, but throughout the Roman Empire, there were more than a few wars. Romans fought great battles in Egypt and in Parthia during that generation. Famine and earthquake. Well, if you know your Bible, you know that there was a collection taken up for the Christians who were suffering during a famine in the period of the book of Acts. And there are also earthquakes recorded by Roman historians such as Tacitus in Syrian Antioch and Phrygia and in Laodicea. Verse 9, there will be persecution, certainly in Jesus, the time from Jesus' day to the fall of Jerusalem. There was a lot of persecution of Christians. The love of many will grow cold. Verse 12, Josephus describes unspeakable brutality of Jew against Jew, even in the days when they were supposed to be fighting the Romans. As I think I may have said, in his view, more Jews killed each other than did the Romans kill among the Jews. Okay, here's one you say, I've got you this time. The gospel will be preached to the whole world. That didn't happen during those years. Well, maybe, maybe not. What does Paul say in Romans 1:8? That the faith of the Romans has been reported all over the world. What does Colossians 1, verse 6 and 23 say? The gospel has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. Now, fully? No. But to the world that those people knew? Yes. Fully evangelized? No. But was the gospel proclaimed? Jesus didn't say the whole world will be evangelized. He didn't say there will be Christians in every nation. He said the gospel will be proclaimed. And that happened in that generation, so far as they knew. Again, is there a further fulfillment to come? It's a foreshadowing of the final. And the gospel will be preached to all the nations, truly all the nations, before the end. Then there are other things in it that I think we would all agree certainly do refer to the fall of Jerusalem. Verses, for example, 15 and following, when you see the abomination standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And if you're on your rooftop, don't go down and take anything out of your house. If you're in the field, don't go back and get your cloak. Pray that you're not a pregnant woman or a nursing mother in those days. Now you see, that has to refer to the fall of Jerusalem. There's no point in Jesus saying, now listen, on the judgment day, if you're on a rooftop when Christ comes, don't go down and get a cloak. That's nonsense. Or to say, hope why would you hope you're not pregnant or nursing mother? Well, because you've got to flee. You've got to leave Jerusalem. But of course, you can't flee from Christ on the last day, right? So that has to be referring to teaching that will preserve the church so they'll not be destroyed by Rome. Now, there are some things in this part of the Bible that you may say really don't fit very well. And here you might say, no, this has to refer to the fall of to the end of time. Verse 29, the sun will be darkened in those days. The moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky. The Son of Man, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations will mourn. I do think it's true that here we're sort of breaking the mold. And Jesus is indeed pressing on to talk about the judgment day. But yet there is a sense in which even these things were partially fulfilled for Jerusalem. The language here, do you see it? Sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light. Where does that come from? Look at your Bibles. Where does it come from? Okay, it comes from Daniel. It comes from Isaiah. And in those places, those prophecies were applied to the fall of Babylon. The day when Babylon fell for the nation of Babylon would be the day when the sun was darkened and the moon would not give its light and the stars would fall. For before God, that nation was judged in that day. There are lots of dress rehearsals for Babylon, for Idumea, for Egypt, to warn people in this day the judgment is coming. And they all are a real judgment in their own right, but they also point to the final judgment. So I'm saying the first reference here is to the fall of Jerusalem. And that liberates us, don't you see? I don't know if you know why I'm talking about this, but this is relevant. See, it liberates us from the foolish quest to find out the day. So many Christians have wasted so much time on charts and graphs and prophecy conferences. You could make fun of it, but I'd rather be sad. It's sad to see Christians neglecting the word of Christ. It's so plain, you don't know the day. You don't know the hour. The signs that are given are not signs to tell you when the judgment day is coming. The signs of wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes were given primarily to the Jews, to the Christians among the Jews, so they would know and be preserved. They're not for us. They're not for our generation. For our generation, the word, the main word, again, there's some allusion to the final day, but the main word for us is, no one knows about that day or that hour. Therefore, keep watch. Always be ready, because you don't know the hour. If somebody said to you, hey guys, the Lord's going to come in the year 2018, what would you be prone to do? Slough off and kind of get busy around 2017, right? And if somebody said the Lord's going to come in the year 3822, that could be harmful. But Jesus says simply, you don't know the day. As it was in the day of Noah, nobody knew, so it will be, verse 39, at the coming of the Son of Man. No one will know. Therefore, verse 42, keep watch because you don't know on what day the Lord will come. He just keeps saying it over and over and over. You don't know the day. You don't know that. He says it about five times to make it clear that we shouldn't worry ourselves with the date. The issue is not when he will come. The issue is, will you be ready? It's not a timing issue. It's a spiritual issue. That's why I'm saddened by prophecy conferences that set dates and examine signs and predict in these ways. Jesus tells us in four parables that I'm going to go through very rapidly about getting ready. The first is a very simple one, it's barely even a parable, in which Jesus says simply that he will come like a thief in the night. Now, when is a thief in the night going to come? When you don't expect him. That's the whole point. He doesn't say, well, I see all the lights are on, they're watching the news, so I'll break in now. He breaks in when you don't expect him. Jesus comes when you don't expect him, therefore always be ready. That's verses 42 to 44. The second one is telling us not simply to be ready at every time. That's the point of the first one. The point of the second one is that since you don't know the time, 24, 45 to 51, since you don't know the time, do your duty while the master's away. Take care of his household. Do his work. Be faithful so the master will be pleased whenever he comes. The third parable is the parable of the 10 virgins. And this parable tells us that Jesus will delay. You don't know the time. That's the whole point. The 10 virgins or maidens didn't know when the bridegroom would come. But then it adds this wrinkle. The wrinkle it adds is this. It may be longer than you think. It'll be long enough for you to get drowsy. Long enough for you to say, I'm not really prepared to wait that long. I've got to fall asleep. I don't have enough oil. And then suddenly he'll come. Will you be ready? Are you ready to endure for a long time? That's the point of that parable. And then finally, the parable of the talents makes the point that while you are always ready, and while you're waiting and being dutiful, and while you're ready to wait a long time, you must also be busy about the Lord's work, taking what he has given you, multiplying those talents, developing them, making a difference in this world, so that when Christ comes, you will be commended for your toil for him and what you did with the treasures that he entrusted to you.